Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From EMG Media, this is Ariel Castro. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Tonight we're going to head to Tremont, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm going to discuss a rather striking case of a savage and brutal criminal who is hiding behind the facade of normalcy. We are going to discuss the kidnapping spree of Ariel Castro. That's right, spree.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Mike Dunstan. We are still following that breaking news out of West 25th Street in Seymour, about a block away from Cleveland's Tremont neighborhood. Now, three women missing for years found alive. It really is some good breaking news here inside the home that you see right behind me. Now, police say that three men are in police custody. It's that home that has a light on. It's that White House there with the flag. Now, overnight, police continue to search this house on Seymour Avenue. News Channel 5's Stephanie Ramirez spoke to a neighbor who says he actually knew one of the suspects very well.
I know I'm not the only one on the block that feels ashamed that we didn't notice anything. I mean, I feel like my head's low. Work at a school, work with kids, you know, my head, I have a heavy heart right now.
Juan Perez says he grew up two houses down from the house, 2207 Seymour Avenue, where police found not one, not two, but three missing women alive. Quite the shock to detectives. Perez says it was an even greater pill to swallow for neighbors and described what the homeowner was like.
He was a good guy to the kids that were here. I don't think he had any bad intentions with the kids that were on the block, but I didn't think nothing of it.
That's the kind of guy Perez says the suspect, Ariel Castro, made himself out to be, not shy to attend a backyard barbecue. Perez also said he would see a bus parked in front, but thought the suspect maybe had a second property because the suspect, according to Perez, would only visit the house sometimes 10 minutes or an hour at a time.
Now it's like red flag, red flag, red flag, red flag. Somebody should have said something. And my sister, actually a few years ago, heard a scream. She called the police.
But he says they didn't know where the scream came from then. As the neighborhood now wraps their head around who was living next door, Perez says, let this serve as a lesson.
We got to start being, you know, close-knit, really close-knit, because this can't happen. This really can't happen. This is bogus.
And actually, many people in this community, which is predominantly a Hispanic community, said they know at least one of the suspects, many of those people expressing outrage as this investigation continues. On Seymour Avenue, Stephanie Ramirez, News Channel 5.
Between 2002 and 2004, a seemingly normal family man abducted and imprisoned three women in his home for over a decade, and subjected them to continual physical abuse, sexual assault, emotional battery, violent rape, induced abortion, and unwanted pregnancies. For the three women, who were named Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Gina De Jesus, it was the nearest experience to living in hell they could possibly endure. Evil personified. When they came face to face with the devil on earth. This week's episode highlights the kidnapping cases of Puerto Rican-born Ariel Castro, a story that gripped not just the nation in the United States, but the world with shock and terror when it emerged in 2013. So how did Castro manage to pull off his wicked plan, and how did his three male captives survive the ordeal? Well, you'll be amazed by the details of the women's harrowing experiences inside Castro's, quote, house of horrors, and ultimately their unexpected and lucky escape into the fate that awaited them afterwards. Before Ariel Castro was sentenced to life plus 1,000 years in prison, without the possibility of parole, in 2013, he addressed the court before him. He said, Quote, "I'm not a monster. I'm really a happy person inside." But could a person who is truly happy inside display behaviors and commit actions that would show the exact opposite? But initially, let's start with Castro's earlier life. A product of a broken family at a very young age, Ariel Rodriguez Castro was born in Yacao, Puerto Rico, on July 10, 1960. He was the third of four siblings. His parents, Liliana Rodriguez and Pedro Castro, constantly fought and eventually divorced before Ariel started school, leaving his mother to care for him and his three siblings alone. Later, the family relocated to the United States of America. The family, sans father, first settled in Reading, Pennsylvania, but then moved on to Cleveland, Ohio, where Ariel's father Pedro and his half-siblings had migrated to previously. The family hoped that by moving closer to their father, that he would provide support and welfare for them. Liliana was keen on this idea, and it worked for Pedro too, even though Pedro wouldn't send a penny to Liliana for the children. Still, he was there if she needed a babysitter, I guess. It was a huge issue, though, as Liliana later remarried, giving Ariel four more siblings, meaning that there was now 10 of them in that house. Ariel pursued his education in Cleveland and graduated from Lincoln West High School in 1979. He studied music and regularly attended church with his family, presenting as a model Christian. Soon after graduation, Ariel met Grimilda Fegaro, a woman who lived across the street from the Castro family. Ariel and Grimilda found romance, and that led to marriage and four children. The couple and their children lived with both Ariel's mother and siblings and Grimilda's family for more than a decade before they moved into their own house in 1992. Located at 2207 Seymour Avenue in Tremont, on Cleveland's west side, the 1,400-square-foot property consisted of two stories, four bedrooms, one bathroom, and an unfinished basement. The neighborhood is one of the oldest parts of the state, and was historically home to a diverse and multicultural selection of groups, which probably made Ariel and his family comfortable living there. Whilst Ariel Castro was never a model family man or employee, he was a tyrant to his wife. He chose to stay silent about her suffering. But because she suffered in silence, people around them sincerely viewed Ariel as a good-natured, friendly, and helpful neighbor. Well, it was precisely when Ariel's own family moved into the new house that his sickening, abusive, and violent side started to emerge. At least to those closest to him, attested Grimilda's sister, Alita. Ariel seemed to find pleasure in making his wife his punching bag, both physically and emotionally. That old chestnut. He subjected her to significant abuse that broke her nose, ribs, and arms. He cracked her skull, scarred her mentally, inflicting the worst psychological trauma imaginable. She hid bruises and abrasions under her clothes, blaming visible injuries on clumsiness. Grimilda was embarrassed to be in the situation that she was, but felt powerless to do anything about it. In 1993, after Ariel threw Grimilda down the stairs so severely that she needed immediate medical attention, but despite her injuries, she again refused to file a police report, and the incident was essentially hushed up. Ariel actually expected to be arrested for this assault. But when nothing happened, this only empowered Ariel, making him think that he could get away with his abuse no matter what. But in the mid-1990s, he inflicted a head injury on Grimilda that caused a serious blood clot and an inoperable tumor. Ariel was arrested, but released a day later, as Grimilda did not press charges and even requested his release. But finally, by the late 1990s, Grimilda, worn down and tired of the abuse, eventually mustered up the confidence and filed for divorce, securing the custody of their four children, Arlene, Antonio, Angie, and Amelia. She subsequently moved out of the family home with them. But her nightmares still continued as her ex-husband pursued, blackmailed, and continued to threaten her psychologically. Whilst Grimilda sought a restraining order, which was issued on three separate occasions, each was also revoked. Ariel was detained, but was again lucky, as police didn't press any charges. Ariel continued to threaten and attack Grimilda after their marriage, and in 2005, Grimilda filed further charges against Ariel, accusing him of inflicting multiple severe injuries upon her, and of frequently abducting their daughters to keep them away from her. The court granted her a temporary restraining order against Ariel, but it was dismissed just a few months later. It's likely that each of the times authorities absolved Ariel from his abusive behaviour, it only led to a hardening of his criminal instincts, and actually fed his disturbed desires. Side note, complications with Grimilda's brain tumour actually led to her death in April of 2012. But by then her children were all grown and independent, though still maintained a warm relationship with their father. Ariel Castro, now left to his own devices and perhaps lonely in his two-storied home, felt that he needed to fill it up, shall we say. Thus began his kidnapping spree. Michelle Knight was born on April the 23rd, 1981. She dreamed as a young girl of becoming a firefighter, and later a career in veterinary medicine, influenced entirely by her love for animals. She was nicknamed Shorty in school, but also bullied for her height, and she was actually assaulted on one occasion. Michelle became a teenage mother at 17 and decided to drop out of school. She devoted her time to her son, Joey, but Joey was sadly taken away from her and placed into foster care at just 2 years old. Joey had gotten injured by an abusive boyfriend of Michelle's mother. His leg was broken, so the social services stepped in. It devastated Michelle, who promised to regain custody of her son as soon as she possibly could. But her efforts were derailed when Ariel Castro abducted her on August the 23rd, 2002, while she was on her way to a social services appointment about regaining custody of her son. Michelle couldn't locate the building for her appointment. But then, like a knight in shining armor, Castro appeared and offered Michelle a ride to her destination. She was late and in a panic. She went to a convenience store to ask for directions. Castro overheard her asking the shop worker for directions and said he could give her a lift. She recognized him as the father of a younger girl who had attended her school. So Michelle said to Castro, quote, "I think I know you. Your daughter's name is Emily, right?" Castro replied, "Yes, I am. It's a small world after all, isn't it?" Michelle accepted the offer of a lift as she felt that she knew who he was. Plus, she really didn't want to be late for her appointment. She was desperate. But instead of driving to the social services office, Castro headed to his Tremont house. There was a note stuck on his car advertising puppies for sale. Michelle told him Joey loved puppies. Well, Castro reacted by telling Michelle that he'd give a puppy to her son, if she liked. But Castro didn't have any puppies. Michelle noticed he was driving the wrong way. But when she asked why, he said he was popping into his house on the way to get a puppy for Joey. Castro pulls into the driveway and then locked the gate behind the car. Strange, Michelle thought. She'd never seen anybody lock their gate. And Castro said it was because it's a really bad neighborhood. So okay, she thought. After they pulled in, they go into the house and Castro turns around and he locks the door behind them. Then he says, quote, "The puppies are upstairs." As Michelle gets close to the stairs, she notices that she doesn't hear any puppies. She asked him why, and Castro replies that, well, they're taking a nap. She should have really been suspicious already. When the two of them get up to the second floor, Michelle has since stated that she had a fear of dread come over her, where she knew she wasn't getting out of there. Michelle stated that as she got to the top of the stairs, she started to visibly shake. Castro noticed and said, quote, "You don't have to be worried." But Michelle knew that there was something wrong, and it was already too late. Then, as the two entered a room at the top of the stairs, Castro slams shut the door behind them both and quickly turned the lock. That was the start of Michelle's 11-year captivity. Castro ripped a photograph of Michelle's son in front of her and said that she wouldn't be leaving the house for a very long time. Her hands and feet were tied up together, and she was left in a tiny room for 3 days without food initially. Castro severely beat and assaulted Michelle, chained her in the basement for days. He starved her, deprived her of water, tortured her, and repeatedly abused her. She was unable to move and begged him for her release, promising her silence if he did. Additionally, during Michelle's 11 years in captivity, Castro impregnated her during his rapes on at least 5 occasions. Castro would kick Michelle's stomach repeatedly and starve her until she miscarried the babies. Michelle's family reported her missing the day after Castro locked her up. But since Michelle was already 21 years old at the time, her missing persons report wasn't given much priority by law enforcement. In fact, local police believed that she just ran away willingly, perhaps out of stress or anger over losing her son's custody. Michelle's own family actually believed this too, and put very little effort into looking for her, aside from putting up flyers in their neighborhood. Interesting fact, at one point, Ariel Castro even helped post flyers with Michelle's photo around the city for her family, all while she remained a prisoner in his basement. You see, Castro's house was only 2 blocks away from where Michelle lived. For 11 years, she was locked up, just 2 blocks away from home. Now, Michelle didn't have the greatest of upbringings. She grew up in Cleveland and spent most of her childhood in a house on West 60th Street. Her early years were marred with abuse, including sexual abuse by a male relative, which deeply traumatized her and affected her sense of self-worth. Michelle grew up in poverty, often acting as a caretaker for her younger siblings. At the age of 14, she briefly ran away from home, living beneath a bridge on a nearby piece of wasteland. She had a troubled youth and already had a police record. When she was 17, she told the police that she had been assaulted at school, but ultimately she felt that the police ignored her complaints. She became pregnant with her son Joey at 17 and decided to drop out of school to focus on motherhood the following year. Michelle had never been treated with much respect, nor valued during her life. In fact, 15 years after she vanished, Michelle's name was removed from the National Crime Information Database, as she was deemed a runaway and that no crime had taken place. There was not an extensive investigative effort into Michelle's disappearance, and undoubtedly, Castro scored another victory and sense of growing invincibility for his dark plan. Inside Castro's house, for the next 11 years, Michelle endured nightmare after nightmare. She was raped, starved, chained up, tortured, and beaten. Castro's abuse was relentless, daily. But Michelle wouldn't suffer alone for long.
All these weird things that I've noticed over the years, like about, you know, how he kept his house locked down so tight, certain areas, and, you know, how if we'd be out at my grandma's having dinner, he would disappear for an hour or so and then come back, and there would be no explanation where he went. Like, everything's making sense now. It's all adding up. And I'm disgusted. I'm horrified.
Did you ever try to get into that basement?
Not since when I was very young, when my mom was still living there. I did pick the locks on the basement, you know, because there was a cheap master lock on the door. Picked the lock, and we went snooping. And I remember there being a fish tank down there, which was odd because there was nobody down there to look at the fish.
Did you ever see any signs of a 6-year-old there?
I never saw signs in the house. I never saw, you know, her with him.
Your family is attached to this stigma. What is the message that you want to tell people that they might not understand?
That my father's actions are not a reflection of everyone in the family. They're definitely not a reflection of myself or my children. We don't have Munster in our blood.
You never want to talk to your dad again?
No. I have no problem cutting him out of my life. I have no problem doing that. I never want to see him again. And another thing that I would like to ask him is, when did you think this was going to be over? How did you think it was going to end? You're 52 years old. Did you think that you can carry this charade forever? What did you think that was going to happen?
On April 21st, 2003, the day before she was supposed to mark her 17th birthday, Amanda Berry was getting ready for work. She attended high school and worked part-time in a local Burger King. Like Michelle Knight, Amanda was born in Cleveland, Ohio, on April 22nd, 1986. She was a hard-working teenager, and she took the job at Burger King in order to help out her family financially. On that fateful April 21st, as she was getting ready for work, in the back of her mind, Amanda actually considered calling in sick that day, since it was her birthday the following day. But she didn't like being dishonest, so she reported to work as normal. After her shift ended at 8 p.m, she called her sister, asking her for a lift home. But she didn't have any luck. Her sister couldn't pick her up. So Amanda decided to walk. It wasn't that far anyway, just around a mile. But it was while Amanda was walking that she encountered a familiar van parked in a driveway. Sat in the van was a man and a girl, roughly Amanda's age. The girl looked familiar, so Amanda smiled at her while walking down the street. Later, Amanda was followed by the van, and the man inside was now seemingly alone. He asked her if she needed a ride home. Amanda recognized that it was Ariel Castro, the father of Arlene Castro, who was her classmate back in middle school. Thus, she was happy to hop into the van without hesitation and accept the lift. When Castro asked Amanda if she would like to go with him to his house to see Arlene, the unsuspecting birthday girl said yes, why not? She thought it was polite, especially as her father had offered her a lift home. So when Castro and Amanda entered the home, Castro said his daughter might be taking a bath, so he guided Amanda around the house. Castro took her upstairs and showed her a mystery woman who was asleep in a bedroom in front of a television set that was switched on. That girl was Michelle Knight, Castro's captive for almost a year by then. Then he brought Amanda into the next bedroom, and this is where he raped her in the dark. Following this vicious attack, Castro then carried Amanda down to the basement, where he taped her wrists and legs and secured her further with a leather belt around her ankles. Amanda recalled what happened next. Quote,
"I was so scared that I was going to die. I really didn't think that I was going to ever make it home."
When her mother, Luana Miller, reported Amanda missing, the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation said that they considered her daughter a runaway. But Luana argued that Amanda would never run away, especially a day before her birthday. Then, a week after Amanda went missing, an anonymous man called Luana using her daughter's mobile phone and said, quote,
"I have Amanda. She's fine. And she will be coming home in a couple of days."
This phone call convinced the OBCI that Amanda was indeed missing and being held against her will. Luana extended huge efforts to accord more coverage about her daughter's disappearance, but she sadly died of heart failure in March of 2006, without ever seeing or talking to Amanda again. Over the next decade, Amanda would face the same horrific fate as Michelle. Beaten, starved for days, regular rape and torture, physical and emotional abuse, and vicious, depraved attacks.
aunt and her cousin hang new flyers, hoping this time they'll bring some answers.
We try and we hope every year that's, you know, something, somebody somewhere will say something. It's just really hard.
It's devastating.
It was about 7:45 on the evening of April 21st. Amanda had just left work at Burger King at West 110th and Lorraine. Not far from here, yellow ribbons can be seen outside the home of Amanda's sister, Beth, the last person in the family to speak to Amanda that night.
She said, my ride's here, and I'll call you as soon as I get home. I called her back, not even 2 minutes later. No answer, nothing.
And she never said who the ride was?
No, and I always asked her that, but that one day I didn't, and that's a regret I hold.
Beth says her sister was a happy girl who was looking forward to her 17th birthday the next day. She fears she may have been kidnapped for human trafficking.
I just love you. I miss you. If you can come home, just come home.
On April 2nd, 2004, Castro set out to capture a third victim. It seems two just weren't enough. 14-year-old Georgina De Jesus was known to everyone as Georgina. That includes to one of her best friends, Arlene. Arlene Castro, Ariel's own daughter. But Castro was also a friend of Gina's dad, Felix De Jesus. So on that bright April day, after their classes at Wilbur Wright Middle School, Arlene and Gina had planned a sleepover at Gina's house, but Arlene wasn't allowed to do so by her mother. So instead, the two girls went their separate ways. Arlene was the last person Gina was seen with before she disappeared. Gina's mother usually gave her daughter bus fare for coming home from school, but the teenager would instead save the money for snacks, as she did most days, and walk home instead. Gina walked that afternoon too. It was around 40 blocks to her home, roughly 1.5 to 2 miles, or 2.5 kilometers. On her way, she would pass through commercial areas and other rundown, not-so-reputable areas used by Cleveland residents as the so-called red light district of the city. Whilst walking alone, a dark red vehicle pulled up to the curb. Behind the wheel was Castro. He asked Gina if she'd seen his daughter Arlene, to which she gave an affirmative answer. "Can you help me find her?" he then asked. Gina happily agreed because they were friends and she felt relaxed around Ariel. It was Gina's dad after all. She knew him. Gina also thought that Mr. Castro, a friend of her dad's, would drop her off at home afterwards. But instead, they headed to the Castro house in the Tremont area. It was daytime, and yet no one witnessed the kidnapping. The streets were unusually empty. At Castro's house, he attempted to molest Gina. Naturally, she protested and said, quote, "What are you doing? You could go to jail." This surprised Castro and he was taken aback. Castro told Gina she could go home, but home for the next 10 years was the basement of Castro's house, where Gina was chained up. When it became known that Gina was missing, there was no Amber Alert issued, something which hugely annoyed her parents. For those listeners outside of the United States, an Amber Alert is a message distributed by the Child Abduction Alert System asking the public for help in finding a missing child. The message is broadcast to all mobile phones within the vicinity. The story also aired on the Fox television show America's Most Wanted. The disappearance was also quickly linked to Amanda Berry's kidnapping a year earlier, but Castro remained unsuspected. Castro again voluntarily participated in the search for the missing girls, even though the entire time he was treating Gina like his other two victims by keeping them imprisoned in his basement. The FBI released a composite sketch of a possible suspect, a Hispanic-looking man, roughly Castro's age, but Castro himself was never a suspect in the girls' disappearance. Police kept the investigation active and offered $25,000 in reward money for any information about Gina's disappearance. But nothing helpful came from those efforts or from the public.
Now that I'm looking back and just how weird he was sometimes and violent to his wife, yeah, and controlling to her,
not letting her walk to the store, just little things like that. You know, she was never allowed out of his sight. Yeah.
He would sometimes leave their door open to tempt them with freedom. Instead of birthdays, the three girls were forced to celebrate their abduction day, commemorating the anniversaries of their imprisonment. The women lived as if in a dollhouse together, yet separate, and always at the hand of a man in control who came and went as he pleased. Michelle was typically kept with Gina, but as the most defiant one, Michelle was often in trouble with Castro. He withheld her food the most, restrained her to a support beam in the basement, and beat and raped her more than the other two girls. Castro struck Michelle with dumbbells, punched her repeatedly in the head, and slammed her against the basement wall. Michelle's left ear was severely impaired, and her face was partially deformed from the beatings. She later required facial reconstructive surgery. Meanwhile, Amanda was moved to an upstairs closet and chained to a radiator. She too was repeatedly raped, and eventually, Amanda got pregnant and delivered a baby girl, which she named Jocelyn, on Christmas Day in 2006. Following her release, Amanda stated the following, quote,
"This is his kid, you know. How do I feel about that? Well, she resembles him a lot, and I look at her, and I just felt like she's mine, you know? She's mine."
Amanda actually taught her daughter how to read and write while in captivity. Baby Jocelyn proved to be a distraction for the imprisoned women and for their tormentor. Castro actually grew fond of what would be his youngest child, and he allowed Jocelyn to play in the backyard or park. She attended Sunday church services with him, and he even took her to visit his mother. Ariel Castro maintained a seemingly normal outside life when he inflicted terror and pain upon his three captives. When family members visited him, he used locks to keep them from going into the basement and other parts of the house. Once, one of Castro's daughters visited, he forced Michelle, Amanda, and Gina to hide together in the basement. It crossed their minds to call for help, but they didn't, out of fear. There was always a chance. What if he finally flipped and killed everybody? Gina later said. Castro lived alone on Seymour Avenue and continued to work as a school bus driver. He played guitar in several bands, regularly taking part in city festivals, and he was known as a good-natured, hospitable neighbor. Nevertheless, there were oddities in Castro's behavior that went unnoticed. For instance, he was prosecuted several times for traffic violations, including speeding and making dangerous U-turns while driving his school bus. These infractions would ultimately lead to fines and a suspension, culminating in his firing in early 2013 after a particularly dangerous maneuver which endangered his passengers. In regard to his musical pursuits, Castro frequently changed musical groups due to tardiness and disrupting rehearsals and concerts. He regularly hosted backyard barbecues for neighbors and family. By all accounts, Castro just seemed like a friendly neighborhood guy. Yes, he could be odd, but so what? His strangeness did not raise any concerns. He was seen as eccentric, but ultimately harmless. But now, no longer earning $18.91 per hour as a bus driver, his house was in danger of getting repossessed after 3 years of unpaid real estate taxes. In 2013, Amanda Berry's daughter Jocelyn may have been a product of Ariel Castro's insatiable sexual manipulation, and some people see the innocent child as a disgrace. But she proved to be a great blessing and a savior on a miraculous spring day. On May 6th, 2013, when young Jocelyn was just 6 years old, Castro left the house to run some errands. Jocelyn innocently happened to tell Amanda that she couldn't find her dad. Amanda stated, quote,
"My heart immediately started pounding because I'm like, should I chance it? If I'm going to do it, I need to do it now."
Amanda saw that her bedroom door had been surprisingly left unlocked. Castro had forgotten to lock the big inside door too, which was wired to an alarm. Beyond that, the storm door was padlocked, but Amanda was still able to squeeze it open an inch or two and tightly force out an arm and scream for help. She could see neighbors through the small crack in the door. She screamed and shouted with all the energy she could muster, And finally, neighbor Charles Ramsey broke down the door and called 911. Amanda pleaded for help. This is a 911 call.
Leave a 911.
Hello, please. Help me, I'm Amanda Berry.
You need police, fire, or ambulance?
I need police.
Okay, and what's going on there?
I've been kidnapped, and I've been missing for 10 years, and I'm here. I'm free now.
Okay, and what's your address?
2207 Seymour Avenue.
2207 Seymour. Looks like you're calling me from 2210.
Huh?
Looks like you're calling me from 2210.
I can't hear you.
It looks like you were calling me from 2210 Seymour.
Yeah, I'm across the street. I'm using the phone.
Okay, stay there with those neighbors talking. Talk to the police when they get there.
Okay.
Okay,
talk to the police when
they get there. Okay. Hello? Yeah, talk to the police when they get there.
Okay, are they on the way right now?
We're going to send them as soon as we get a car open.
No, I need them now before we get back.
All right, we're sending them, okay?
Okay, I mean, like,
who's the
right
guy?
Now?
Who's the guy you're, who's the guy who went out?
His name is Ariel Castro.
All right, how old is he?
He's like 52.
All right, and,
Steven, I'm Amanda Berry. I've been on the news for the last 10 years.
Okay, I got that
with
here.
Martina.
I already... And, you said, what was his name again?
Ariel Castro.
And is he white, black, or Hispanic?
I'm Hispanic.
And what's he wearing?
I don't know, because he's not here right now. That's
when he left,
got away.
When he left, what was he wearing?
It's a pity. What?
Right, the police are on the way. Talk to them when they get there. Okay?
I
told you they're on the way. Talk to them when they get there, okay?
All right, okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
She had grabbed Ramsey's phone and begged the dispatcher to send police to help her and her fellow prisoners at 2207 Seymour. Cleveland police arrived within minutes. They entered the home and found Michelle and Gina chained up in two different rooms upstairs. Stepping outside of the horror house, the three women, plus baby Jocelyn, blinked in the Ohio sun, free for the first time in more than a decade. The brightness of daylight hurt the women's eyes, and they could barely see. The day that Michelle, Gina, Amanda, and Jocelyn regained their freedom was also the same day that Ariel Castro lost his. Police arrested Castro on May the 8th, 2013. He was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape, which carried prison sentences of 10 years to life in the state of Ohio. On June 7th, a grand jury indicted him on 329 total counts, but he pleaded not guilty and requested to forego a lengthy public trial to spare his victims from further trauma, he said. On July 3rd, Castro was deemed mentally competent to stand trial and began his pre-trial hearings. DNA tests confirmed him as Jocelyn's father, but his request to see her was denied. A Cuyahoga County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment and brought a total of 977 counts. This included 512 counts of kidnapping, 446 counts of rape, 7 of gross sexual imposition, 6 of felonious assault, 3 counts of child endangerment, 2 of aggravated murder, and 1 count of possession of criminal tools. Ariel Castro pleaded guilty on July 26th to 937 of those charges against him as part of a plea bargain. His plea bargain called for consecutive sentences of life in prison plus 1,000 years without the opportunity of parole. As part of the plea deal, Castro forfeited his right to appeal and could not profit in any way from his crimes. He also forfeited all of his worldly assets, including his home, which prosecutors announced would be demolished during his trial. Castro was both defiant and remorseful. He tried to depict himself as equally a victim as the three women of his sexual addiction. He claimed that his crimes were not nearly as bad as they sounded, and that his victims lived in comfort with him as willing partners. Most of the sex that went on in the house, he said, was consensual. Castro was found guilty and sentenced on August the 1st, 2013, and he was left completely alone to rot in a prison cell. On September 2nd, 2013, just a month after his incarceration, 53-year-old Ariel Castro was found dead in his detention cell at the Correctional Reception Center in Orion, Ohio. A preliminary autopsy conducted the following day determined that his death was the result of suicide by hanging. Castro had used a bedsheet to achieve this. Some have since stipulated that because of his ravenous sexual appetite, his death may have been accidental and the result of autoerotic asphyxiation rather than suicide, but there is no hard evidence to support this theory. While Castro was consumed by cowardice and ultimately killed himself, his former prisoners and sex slaves found renewed courage and strength. They each rebuilt their lives and reclaimed their freedom. Michelle Knight wrote a New York Times best-selling memoir about the ordeal titled Finding Me, A Decade of Darkness. She changed her name to Lily Rose Lee to start a fresh chapter of her life. She got married on May 6, 2015, and hopes to someday reunite with her son Joey, who was adopted during her confinement. Amanda Berry and Gina D. Jesus also published their own best-selling book titled Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. Both women also received honorary diplomas from John Marshall High School in 2015. Amanda Berry joined the staff of Fox 8 News in Cleveland in February of 2017, where she hosts recurring segments about missing person cases. Gina has volunteered for the Amber Alert Committee, offering comfort to families of abducted children. Castro's son Antonio said in 2014 that he had been to his father's house, and he had seen that some rooms were locked and inaccessible. But his father explained that it was because he was saving money on heating. Antonio said that he never thought anything of it. Castro's horror house was demolished on August the 7th, 2013. Nothing stands there now. Just a bed of flowers in memory to the three captives. Good night, everyone.